This is Frank Hymans interviewing Judy Taylor for the Millers Point Oral History Project. Today is the 21st of February 2006, and this interview is being conducted at Cremorne, New South Wales. This is State Member MP FH45, Side A. Okay, Judy, now we usually start with the beginning, which is your birth, and can you tell me your name and when and where you were born?
My name's Judy Taylor, and I was born on the 5th of the 7th, 49, in Cessnock, New South Wales.
Right. And what was your maiden name?
McCarran.
Right. Is that M-C-C-A-R-R-O-N?
M-C-C-A-R-R-O-N, yep.
Right, okay. Tell me a little bit about your family. What kind of people were there, your parents?
They were wonderful parents. They were very hardworking. My dad started as a miner. His working life in Cessnock. He went on to become a salesman and then owned his own company of door-to-door selling. And then when he sold that, they went into hotels, which eventually led us to Millers Point.
Right, so it was a family of publicans, was it?
Mm-hmm, would you say? It was. Many hotels.
Where did he start, in Cessnock?
No, he actually started at a small hotel in Mernda, in Victoria, which is country Victoria, not so much now, but back then it was. And from there to Albury, to a rather large hotel motel, and there to Sydney, to the Petersham Inn in Petersham, the Royal George, which is now the Slip Inn in Sussex Street, and the Captain Cook Hotel at Millers Point, which he bought twice.
Right, he liked it so much he missed
well,
it?
Well, no, my mum was very homesick because they were in Millers Point for quite a few years, and they sold the hotel, and they had a stud farm out at Ludnam, which they lived for a while. But my mum really missed Millers Point. So he went and approached the people who had bought the hotel from him, and he bought it back.
Probably at a great price too.
Well, more than he sold it for, yes.
Well, that's natural.
And they were there then for another 10 years.
Right. Before we get to that, I'd like to just ask you some questions about your background, school years and so on. What was it like? Where did you grow up, actually, in Cessnock?
No. Well, I did until I was 10. And then we moved to Tamworth, Brisbane, Melbourne, and back to Sydney.
Oh, you've been
so
all over the
schooling,
place.
Schooling was in, you know, quite a lot of schools, because that was Dad's job as well.
Right. Sure, sure. Now, you had a pretty wide education, I guess, in all these
Certainly
different places.
Did. Yeah. Certainly did.
Was your family religious?
No. We're Catholic. But I think we always were Christian people. I'm probably the most religious out of our family, and I still attend St. Bridget's Church at Millers Point 30 years later. So, you know, we grew up in a very Christian family, not necessarily a religious family.
Right, sure, sure. And what were the high school years like, and where did you have your high school?
High school years were in Melbourne. They were fine. Nothing remarkable happened there. And I left school and became a hairdresser.
All right.
In Melbourne, and then I married and had two children, and my marriage didn't last. We broke up, and I came to live at Millers Point, where my mum and dad had a hotel, and that's where I met my now husband,
Russell.
Yes.
So did you actually meet him in the pub?
I did.
The Captain Cook Hotel.
I did, yes. Russ's mother and father and brother drank there. His grandmother lived next door, two doors up from the hotel. And Russ was working in Canberra at the time, and he used to come home at weekends. And he got particularly quite drunk one night. And my father said, you know, that boy shouldn't drive home. And I said, my dad said, you should drive him home. And I said, and how am I going to get back? And Russ, in an inebriated voice, said, I'll drive you back. So, and we've just been together ever since, which is 30 years ago.
Right. Now, Russell's in Canberra again, I believe, is he? Does he work in Canberra a lot?
He does. He does, yes.
Yeah,
he goes backwards and forwards. We were in Canberra for 11 years during our marriage, so...
Right. Now, when your father bought the pub, the Captain Cook Hotel, what state was it in when he bought it?
It had actually recently been renovated when Mum and Dad first bought it the first time, and it had become a yuppies pub at that stage, which didn't suit my dad because they didn't drink enough. And yuppies took up space but didn't drink enough beer. So he very quickly changed the approach to the hotel, that he took out the roast beef lunches and put on some real counter lunches for the wharfies and the tally clerks, and it soon became, you know, a real wharfies pub that were good drinkers, and they made, you know, plenty of money. So it was a great pub. Because the people, that everybody knew everybody, whether they were local wharfies or people that came from Balmain or Glebe, it was a great pub. It was a great camaraderie for people that drank there.
There was a lot of competition for your father. There are lots of pubs in Millers Point.
There are a lot of pubs in Millers Point. But the Captain Cook became the real knockabout bloke's pub. And, you know, we had all walks of life that drank there. The other pubs, when Dad first bought it, it was a 10 till 10 hotel. And you had a lot of, you know, Friday and Saturday nights where you had a lot of drunks there, and you had a lot of fun also, and then Sunday trading. But then he was given the opportunity to make it an early opener, which he took up. And we still got the majority of drinkers during the day. And then when the hotel closed at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock, they then made their way to either the Lord Nelson or the Palisade.
Just have to take a little break for the lawnmower. Now, Judy, what sort of work did you do in the pub? I guess you were a barmaid.
I was a barmaid, and I was a damn good one. I was not allowed to drink. We were never encouraged to drink, but we were encouraged to be good barmaids. And Dad trained. There was myself and another girl, and when the wharfies came for their morning tea, they only had like 15 minutes break. And we used to have to watch every car that pulled up, and we learned what they drank, and we would have their drink on the bar when they walked in the door. And my dad always used to say, you don't make money with empty glasses. So as soon as one was emptied, you had the next one ready for them to drink. And some of them might have, you know, six schooners in their morning tea break. But we had to make sure that we had those six schooners, one after another, poured for them. So we were well known, the good Margaret, her name was, and myself, that if anybody rang and said we're on our way, they knew their beers would be on the bar when they arrived.
That's incredible. Well, that's great foresight by your father. To know exactly what everyone had, so that's
we had to learn it, and we could tell you we actually knew a person by what they drank more than their name, and we always described, you know, the bloke who drinks Reshes that comes in here at 11:10, and we knew who it was rather than what their name was, and we were never allowed to, when I say allowed, it was encouraged that we didn't stand and talk to anyone. Because while ever you talked, there was always somebody behind you that had an empty glass that had to be filled up. And he was a wonderful publican. He had the best beer in Sydney at the time, and he was known for his beer, how good it was. And people used to say, you know, are you ever going to shout? And he'd say, well, when the brewery gives me a keg for nothing, then I'll put on one for nothing.
Now, I heard that at the Captain Cook Hotel that you'd have the blue-collar workers on one end of the bar and the white-collar workers on the other. Was that how it was?
Well, we had the wharfies at one end and we'd have the collar and ties at the other. But the everyday bloke soon sorted out the collar and tie, and it was only the real knockabouts that actually stayed. Because they didn't, I must say, those that used the Cook as their pub, and they called it their pub, they weren't open to, you know, having a lot of strangers around, and unless they, you know, actually got to know you and they welcomed you into their circle, they were very wary of anybody that turned up there who they didn't know.
Why was that? Because of...
Well, a lot of them were... you know, had checkered pasts, and they were the local crooks that used to drink there. We had one, we actually had a police prosecutor that lived at Millers Point at the time, and who my dad nicknamed Elliot Ness, and nobody really liked him, and he was very critical of the crooks that drank at the Captain Cook Hotel. And he ended up one himself. So, you know, it just shows you that money speaks a lot of languages. So, you know, there were a lot of different people that drank at the Cook. And there were husbands and wives that came, and I can't remember their name, but there was one couple, an elderly couple, that came there every Saturday morning. And the crooks, as we called them, they welcomed them. They looked forward to seeing them because they were a really nice couple and they didn't pose any threat to anybody, and they looked after those that they liked, and you were never frightened of them.
When you say crooks, did you mean sort of petty crooks, or they mean hardened criminals?
Well, some of them were criminals, really, you know, good criminals. Some of them were only petty crooks, you know, that would, we used to call them shoplifters, and if they were running short of money, they'd ask you if was there anything you needed uptown, and you could virtually say anything, and they'd go up to the city and bring you back whatever it was that you said you needed, and you'd buy it for a third of whatever the price was.
Well, a lot of the goods in the pub that showed up, were they from the wharves?
Somewhere. But, you know, a lot of them were from, certainly, you know, from containers. There were a lot of things that turned up from, you know, the containers on the wharves. But those crooks did no harm to anyone. They stole, there's no doubt about that. But they certainly didn't do anyone any harm, and they looked after.
Right. Well, I believe there were some notorious murders in Millers Point as well, like Danny Chubb. And
well,
so
Danny was actually, well, I'm sure you've been told, Danny was born and reared in Millers Point. And he, at, you know, back in the early days, Danny was just a crook, you know. He didn't do anybody any harm, but unfortunately drugs came in to play a part in a lot of their lives, and it just changed people's perspective of what crooks and money, you know, speaks all languages. And unfortunately, Danny became involved in drugs. And we actually spoke to him 10 minutes before he was shot. And one of the boys, local kids, came up on his bike singing out that Danny had been gunned down in front of his mother's house.
Is that in High Street?
In High Street, yeah. Next door to the Lance Kindergarten.
Right. That's terrible. Do you know who did it?
No.
No one knows. Or no one will tell, I guess.
Nobody, no.
Even 30 years later?
30 years later, no.
It's a secret, okay. Fair enough. Now, when you first came into Millers Point, you were a bit of a blow-in, as they say. How did the community
take you? We weren't local, put it that way.
No, how did the community take to you, and how did you take to the community?
Well, I think to this day I'm still Russell's wife. He's the local. I'm just the wife. And I think that's how they look upon it. Even though I'm accepted at Millers Point, and our children grew up in Millers Point and they went to school at St. Bridget's, they were locals, Russ was the local, but I just married a local. But they treated you very well. My mother was a very respected lady in Millers Point, and she just loved the people there, as we did, we all did. And people cared for people back then. You know, Millers Point's changed a lot to what it used to be. But people really cared for one another, and we just looked out for one another. But it takes a while for them to accept anybody into their group.
Sure, sure. Now, the pub appears to be famous for its chook raffles.
Yes.
What were they for?
Well, we used to run a chook raffle every Friday night, sometimes Thursdays, for St. Bridget's School and for the football club that was later formed in Millers Point. And many times that one chook could have been won 15 times because people would win it, get, you know, a few beers under their belt and they'd leave and the chook would be sitting on the bar and we'd raffle it again. And there was a lot of money raised for this school back then. That was the school and church, and now it's just the church, but a lot of money was raised for Sister Antoinette, who was the nun teaching at the school at the time. And then, of course, when the football team started again, the monies also went to the football club. But the raffles were famous because the ping pong ball that was drawn out, the numbers, depending who, if anybody they knew, you know, might have needed a chook, nobody ever really saw the number on the ping pong ball, but that person's number was called out. So it was always evenly distributed on who won a chook as to who needed it.
And I believe you could even buy eggs at your pub.
Yes.
How did that happen?
Yeah, well, my mum and dad had a stud farm out at Ludnam, and Dad used to go out every Tuesday. And on his way, he would pass an egg farm. And when he first was coming back, he'd bring one or two dozen back for a couple of the older blokes who drank in the public bar. And then it became well known that, you know, the cook had lovely farm fresh eggs. So it was nothing for on a Tuesday that Dad would bring back 60 dozen eggs, and people would come, you know, from everywhere to get their farm fresh eggs every Tuesday. And so as well as selling a schooner of beer, you'd be selling a schooner of beer and two dozen eggs across the bar.
Most unusual commodity for a pub.
Most unusual. But it went on for a long, long time.
Right.
For years, actually, years.
Now, living in Millers Point, you've just told me already about some of the crooks that went into the pub and so on, but did you feel safe walking around the streets there?
Always. Always safer. It was only in the latter years that when things changed and Millers Point no longer was maritime, it became Housing Commission, and it was only then that a different type of person came to Millers Point. But up until then, it was just generations. The homes went from one generation to another, and you never, ever felt afraid on Millers Point because even your children, everybody knew everybody's child, and you looked out for everybody's kids. You know, your kids could go anywhere, and you always knew somebody would be watching them. So, no, you were never frightened.
Now, those crooks that you mentioned, do they have names?
Yes, they do. Mickle Hurley is one of them, and Abbo Henry, who has a book out now. Nettie Smith used to drink there. There was one chap who used to come there that was known for doing a couple of robberies, and he used to wear a wig. And being a hairdresser in my past life, it was not uncommon for him to ask me, could I cut the wig into different styles so that, you know, he would look different at each job that he might have gone to. But when my mum passed away, she was very loved by all of them. And when she passed away and her funeral was at St. Bridget's, every one of them came to her funeral. And, you know, to me that speaks volumes. They may be crooks, but they were nice people as well.
Yeah, nice. Crooks with a heart.
They were crooks with a heart. And they were crooks also that would, you know, help anybody that was down and out in Miller's Point, and particularly the older men and older ladies who had lived on Miller's Point, you know, for many, many years. They always made sure that there was a dollar in their pocket, particularly the old men, so that they could have a drink. They never saw anybody go without money. We did mention that particular incident.
Yeah, let's talk about that one. Okay, just see. So what were some of the items that were shoplifted?
Well, you could, they would ask you, you know, did you need anything? And, you know, I have been known to say, yes, I would like a Sheridan Duna cover or something, and off they'd go and come back with it. But one particular chap who drank at the hotel, he was known as probably one of the best shoplifters. He used to get dressed in a beautiful suit, and he'd go up to DJs and he'd have a floor manager's badge on his suit. And he's been known to wheel out a rack of men's suits out of DJs, and no questions asked, because people just assumed he worked for David Jones.
So he did it. Interesting. Now, the police must have known about all this, didn't they? The things that were happening around Miller's Point.
I think they did. But, you know, the police aren't... back in the days that I can remember when the crooks were... before drugs were introduced to Miller's Point or to anywhere. You know, I have seen police come to the hotel at the Captain Cook and at the Royal George, which is not far from the Captain Cook. And police would come for their weekend money. And, you know, they'd see one of the crooks drinking at the bar and they'd be called outside and they'd be spoken to. And many of them would come back in and say to Dad, Ronnie, have you got a couple of hundred? I've just been stamped. And if I don't pay off, they'll plant me with something, which meant that they'd either put a gun or something in their pocket and they'd be arrested. So, you know, the police were very aware of these men that drank at the hotel, and they, a lot of them profited from the fact that they were crooks.
Right, yeah, well, we knew about that, yeah. Roger Rogerson's
that's
one
right.
of them, isn't he? Yeah.
That's exactly right.
Now, what's the story that you know about the Golconda diamond?
Well, one of the chaps that drank at the hotel, he, and I can't mention his name, he was the chap that actually took that diamond. So,
from where?
And it's a very famous diamond.
So where was the diamond stolen from?
Well, I can't remember where it was actually taken from, but I know two of the crooks actually who took it were arrested for the robbery, but they were later released because there wasn't enough evidence and the diamond's never been found.
Right. Now, were there any SP bookies at the pub? Oh, most pubs had them.
Plenty of SP bookies, plenty. All in the back room or in the stairway leading up to the... residential part of the hotel. Every Saturday or every race meeting there'd be an SP bookie there, and you could get a bet on anything really. But the police at times knew they were there, and but they would have to do the occasional raid to, you know, just to keep everybody honest and above board. But we had a lot of characters that did SP bookmaking there, one of which was my husband at times. And, you know, you were always worried whether the police would come and, you know, you'd go downstairs and he'd be missing and you'd know very well that there'd been a raid.
Yeah, Russell told us that story about how he was a one-time SP.
Yes.
Interesting story. Okay. Now, who were some of the more local characters? I believe there was one called Mandrake, wasn't there?
Yes, there was Mandrake. There was Terry the Gardener. There were a lot of them. All of them had these names given to them because of either Mandrake, they thought, They called him Mandrake because he was an absolute magician on biting people for money. And he was just, you know, a real character. I remember once he fell off the stool very early one morning in the hotel, and they thought he'd had a heart attack, and they called the ambulance. And then as the ambulance was wheeling him out, he asked them to stop. And he leaned over to my father and said, "Can you give me 20 in case I get thirsty on the way back?" And so, you know, Dad used to say, "I've been bitten in some funny places," he said, "but, you know, never by a bloke who's just had a heart attack being taken to hospital." And he was back within 30 minutes. He'd had not had a heart attack. He really had only just fallen off the stool. And he got a taxi, came back and spent the $20 that he'd bitten Dad for on his way out. So there were a lot of characters that drank there.
Yeah, some unusual nicknames as well.
Certainly was.
Was there a good community spirit in the pub? Like people got together and they sang or that sort of thing? Or?
Yes, we used to have at one stage, there was a chap who used to come every Sunday and his name was Lyle. And on a Friday, he had a stall at the markets. And on a Friday, he'd bring down to the cook whatever fruit and vegetables were left over from the markets, and he'd sell them outside. So you not only got your eggs at the cook, you could also get your fruit and vegetables. And then on a Sunday, this same man would arrive with a portable organ. And he'd come in and he'd set himself up in the saloon bar. And just people just came from everywhere, and the sing-alongs would go for all afternoon, you know, to the point where you thought if you heard Red Red Robin once more, you'd absolutely scream. But the community just embraced the whole concept of the cook. Once Mum and Dad were there, and it became such a meeting place, and it became a place where people felt at ease, they felt comfortable, they felt a family. It was just one happy family, one big family.
And who was Terry?
Terry the gardener.
I think he was a phantom race reporter or something.
Oh, Terry, that's Terry the gardener. He actually worked on the council doing gardens, and that's how he got the name Terry the gardener. But everybody has a story in their life, and Terry probably has one too, but he would have made the most brilliant race caller, because he would very often, well, every Melbourne Cup, he would always do a phantom Melbourne Cup call. But he was just a hopeless, you know, he loved the drink. And probably if he didn't like the drink so much, he may have been another Ken Howard or, you know, Bill Collins on the radio calling races. But his love of rushes was probably far greater than his love of race calling.
Well, at least he enjoyed himself.
He certainly did.
I'll just make an announcement. That's the end of tape number MPFH 45, side A. It's the start of tape number MPFH 45, side B. Now tell me about Aunt Biddy, Judy. Who was she?
Auntie Biddy, well, Biddy was a lady who grew up on Miller's Point. She had a sister Mary and a sister Helen, and her mum and dad, before my time, Russ, had known them all their life. They grew up together. They lived next door to Russ's grandmother. And all our children went to school at St. Bridget's. And Christmas time, when Martin Place would have the Christmas tree up, Biddy would come and collect all the kids of Miller's Point. And they'd start at the village green, which was in the Argyle Cut, and they'd walk down the Argyle Cut, up George Street to Martin Place, do the circle of the city, and then come back up Kent Street. And then she'd deliver them all back to their respective homes. But the kids had their Miller's Point song, and they used to sing the Miller's Point Mob as they walked through the city. And it just, you know, it was just something that if you were to ask those young people today, that's something that they really remember that happened when they were kids, that Auntie Biddy always used to do that at Christmas time, and she'd take them all through town.
Now, I'm very interested in that song. Do you have the words of that by any chance?
I do have the words to that song.
Could you tell us?
I'll say them. I can't sing them, but I'll say them. Hang on a second.
Yeah, sure.
And the kids used to sing, "The Miller's Point mob are we, the Miller's Point mob are we. We're always up to mischief wherever we might be. One day in the courtyard, a copper said to me, 'If you belong to the Miller's Point mob, well, come along with me.' He grabbed me by the collar and tried to run me in. I lifted up my hairy fist and hit him in the chin. How many eggs for breakfast? How many eggs for tea? A loaf of bread as big as your head and a lousy cup of tea." And the kids sang that all the way through the city.
That's brilliant. That's so good. Do you know what the music was? Was it set to any particular tune?
Oh, look, I'm the worst singer in the land and I couldn't begin to. Off this tape, I'll sing it for you.
Try.
No, I couldn't.
Everyone will forgive you.
No, I couldn't.
Okay. <all right. laughs> That's great.
I'll do it for you and then you can put it to music.
Okay. All right. Well, we might revive that one.
You never know.
We could, maybe, hopefully. Now, there were games and stuff played in the pub, wasn't there? What sort of games were organised for the people?
Games? Well, we used to have two up, obviously. On Anzac Day, we used to have one of the biggest two up games in Sydney. And it was quite known for its two up, but it was great. Very rarely was there any trouble. If there was any trouble, it was always from, you know, strangers that dropped in, but never from the locals.
Did you also organise domino games or gin?
Well, that was in the hotel.
In the hotel.
Yeah. Dad played gin and dominoes every day. And there was always a local that would want a game of dominoes or a game of gin. And that just went on every day. Where one of Dad's greatest opponents for dominoes was a chap called Mossy Galvin. And Mossy hadn't had a drink for years and years and years. And in fact, he hadn't been to a hotel for years. And he became friends with Dad, obviously not through drinking, just became friends. And it was somewhere for him to come. And he came every day and they played dominoes every day. And to the point then Mossy would go to the trots with Dad and, you know, do many things. So it was a friendship that was built from dominoes. But there was always a game of gin, always.
Now the Palisade Hotel used to organise golf and so on. It had golf club.
Yeah.
Did the Captain Cook have something similar that they go out at?
No, not a golf club. The football club that when Russ and I had the local mixed business at Miller's Point, which was a couple of doors from the Captain Cook Hotel, and Russ started the football club up again for the local kids at Miller's Point. And the Captain Cook was very, very involved in the local football club. And after every game, we used to have a sausage sizzle every Sunday after the game of football. So that was the main priority of the Captain Cook, was the sponsorship of the new invented Miller's Point football club.
Right.
Yeah.
Russ was probably behind that, was he?
He was. Him and a young chap by the name of Andy Farley and Barney Gardner, all the chaps of, you know, Russ's age that grew up together, and Bobby Gray, who's no longer with us, but Bobby was just absolutely loved the football team. And, you know, on a Sunday morning, not everybody had a car in Miller's Point, but on a Sunday morning, people would come to the hotel as a meeting spot, and those that had a car would try and fit as many people in as possible so that they could take them, you know, to the game, so that they could support the Miller's Point team.
Oh, great. Mm. Now, do you remember Rock's Day, Judy?
Yes, I remember Rock's Day well.
Could you tell me about it?
Yeah, I can. We worked, obviously, in the hotel and we were very, very busy, and you weren't allowed to sell anything in a glass. And anything that could be removed, people removed, even toilet seats. It was just like a pub crawl where people went from one pub to another. And by the time they probably got to the Cook, because they started down in George Street and worked their way around, and we ended up probably with the drunkest lot of the whole day. There were floats. People would dress up as, you know, and they'd do things, have different events in the village green. You know, I don't remember Rock's Day with great warmth, because you could always bet that you finished the night with a fight, because there were always so many drunks around. So, you know, I remember Rock's Days, but I don't remember them with warmth. I remember them as being a real pain.
A bit of a pub crawl, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah.
Right. Now, did you live upstairs in the pub when you
were... We did.
Yeah?
Yes, we did. We lived upstairs, and our kitchen window overlooked the harbour. And we used to have a lot of seamen come into the hotel off the boats, all the container ships. And my mum would look out her kitchen window and you'd see these big container ships in, and we always knew who would be in the pub that night because we knew what seamen were actually on those boats. So, you know, it was just a lovely place to be.
This is that maritime atmosphere that makes it very special too, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It certainly does.
Now, you send your kids, you said, to St. Bridget's School.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the school
across
the road,
yeah.
Very close. How was it there? I mean, what kind of an education did they have?
It was wonderful, St. Bridget's. I think when Rebecca and Paul, our eldest children, went there, at any one time there were probably at the most 18 children, and it was kinder, first and second class. And their sister Antoinette was the teacher there. And they were just her babies, and she was just wonderful, wonderful teacher. And there was another lady there that the children called Miss Mary, who was their music and drama teacher, I suppose. And she taught them all their dancing and their songs. Back in those days, the schoolroom was upstairs. And my mum used to wave to them every day as they walked up the stairs because her bedroom window looked out over St. Bridget's. But it was a wonderful school, and it was one-on-one teaching. And when Rebecca and Paul left there and went to another school, the teachers couldn't believe that children in second class could actually read as well as they did. But it was just, you know, such great teaching. And then when our youngest daughter went there, Louise, the schoolroom had gone downstairs, and Sister Joseph was the teacher then. And I think there were up to maybe 19 or 20 children, and it went to third class. It had gone up a grade. But the same sort of teaching. It was just a very, very unique school for children to go to, and it's very sad to think that no longer exists. It's a part of history, you know, that will never come back. And St. Bridget's is the oldest church in Australia because it has had Mass celebrated there every Sunday since it was first opened, which makes it the oldest continuous use church in Australia. And to have that history in Millers Point is incredible.
Right.
And people, a lot of people didn't realise that, just how old it was.
Right, sure. That's great. You know, it's got the Catholic education system, of course, is generally very good. Did you send them on to Catholic high schools afterwards?
Yes, they've all of them have gone on to Catholic schools. I don't think any of them are practising Catholics now, but they certainly had that education.
Right. Now, tell me a bit about those years that you spent in Millers Point in the mixed business that you bought with Russell. What were they like?
Oh, they were good and bad. It's a hard life, a mixed business. I think, you know, because Russ was the local, it was very hard to say no to people with, you know, to give people credit. And there, you know, once again, Russ was the local, I was the local's wife. And people would deal with Russ more than me because they've known him all his life. It was a hard life in the mixed business, but just to be living in Millers Point was, to me, just wonderful. You have lifelong friends. You have friends that you may not see, but they're your friends forever. That's the sort of people the old Millers Point was.
So has it changed much now?
I think it has. I still go back there every Sunday, and I still have friends there, but it's not like the camaraderie isn't like it used to be, because it's not the generation after generation of the same family. Because it's now Housing Commission, you have it's a very transit sort of a living area as well, where you have halfway houses, and you know, it changed the area completely.
Yeah, bringing the new people.
Yeah, it did.
Well, I guess they don't have the sense of allegiance at the.
Well, they don't, and the hotels have changed. They're also, you haven't got the locals like when we first went to Millers Point. You had people that had lived there for many, many, many years, and the pubs were the locals, you know. And it's in very few places in Sydney now do you have a local pub, and Millers Point, to that extent, has changed. You know, and I think probably now the more local pub would be the Palisade, because it's the one that hasn't been really touched.
How does the Captain Cook Hotel compare now to the time when you and your parents had it, do you think?
Well, I don't think it does compare. You know, it's a totally different hotel. It has a restaurant upstairs. You know, I've been to the restaurant there, and I think, my God, I'm eating in my mum's bedroom, and in her lounge room that we were never allowed to go into, because even though it was a hotel, it was our home, and never the two met. My mother wouldn't allow alcohol upstairs, even though we lived in a hotel. We never had alcohol upstairs. My dad never drank upstairs. Even though he loved to drink, it was never upstairs. And when I go to the restaurant at the Cook now, I think, oh, my mum would turn in her grave if she thought we were sitting in her lounge room eating food and drinking. But it hasn't got, even downstairs, it hasn't got the warmth that it had. It hasn't got that comfortable old shoe feel when you walk in.
Which year was it actually that your father bought the lease, and when did you actually leave there, do you think?
Goodness, Frank, I'd have to really think on that. I'm really not good with dates. I'm trying to think. Paul would have been 3, so maybe 74 that he went there, right up until the 90s. He was there.
Oh, right.
So it was a long time.
Did your father retire from the pub business?
He did. And only because it became, the Maritime was selling off all its properties to the Housing Commission. And the Cook needed, you know, some things done to it. And I think Mum and Dad had, by that stage, just thought, well, it's probably easier to retire. And even though I think he regretted it when he left there, because they missed Millers Point so much. And they couldn't live there, you see, because that was Housing Commission. They wouldn't have been entitled to a home there. I think had they been able to have sold their hotel and still been able to live at Millers Point, would have made them very happy people, but you couldn't do that.
Right.
You had to be on the, you know, a certain criteria to get into a housing commission home.
So your father would have been paying rent to the Maritime Services Board
when he had
the hotel.
He had the lease.
And
he
later didn't... to the Department of Housing then, was it?
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. He never ever owned the freehold. When it was the people who have it now, they own it lock, stock and barrel. Back in the maritime days, you couldn't buy the freehold. You could only buy the lease.
So they actually bought it then. It's freehold now.
It's freehold now, yes.
So the Department of Housing sold it off then, didn't
yes.
it?
Yes. Yes,
oh, right.
As did all the hotels.
All the hotels were sold
mm-hmm.
off, were they?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right. Okay. When you look back now at those years at Millers Point, how do you see them? Do you look at them through sort of pink-coloured glasses, or are you a bit nostalgic about it?
Even though I was born in Cessnock, and Cessnock is Cessnock, to me, Millers Point is probably where I feel more at one with. That's my home. And because I spent probably more years there than anywhere else I've ever lived at Millers Point. And because it's Russ's history is Millers Point. Our children, that's their history is Millers Point. I think it's a wonderful place. I think it's sad when I see some of the things that happen there now, because it was such a unique, it was a country town in a city, and it was a unique place to live, Millers Point. I think people that live there, I feel very privileged to have lived there, because I've made friends that will be my friends for life. And I've lived in many places, but my friends that I have at Millers Point, they're the ones that have sustained, that will be with me for forever.
That's nice. What would you like to see happen now at Millers Point? They've got all kinds of plans now for the development of the Patrick Wharfs. You know, they're going to go and they're going to build high-rise offices.
I think that's sad. I think for that to happen, you can't stop change or progress. That's the way life is. But I think Millers Point will lose its total uniqueness, because there is nowhere else like it. If you, you liken it to Port Melbourne in Melbourne, because it's a real working class, wharfy sort of town. It's no longer that. It's eventually only the wealthy will be able to live at Millers Point, because I believe that in time there won't be any housing commission there. It'll only be a matter of time and they'll rehouse the people that are there, and it'll become somewhere that only those with a big checkbook will be able to afford to live there. And I think that's sad, because it's the beginning of Sydney, and they've changed all that, and that they'll lose it all, and they'll lose it for children, that to be able to take children there and see it as normal, ordinary people live there. And when all this progress happens, that won't be there anymore. It'll be somewhere for the wealthy to live.
Some people have already told us, they said, where are the children? They're gone.
They are gone.
You hardly see a child now at Millers Point.
No.
They're not playing in the streets.
And if you do, and I don't mean this in any other way, the majority of children in Millers Point are Asian children. We have at church particularly, we have a very large number of Asian children that go to church, which is wonderful, but we there are not a lot of young children down there. And if there are, they're certainly not encouraged to come to church, which in itself, is different as well. I don't know. I can't answer that question. Where are the children?
Yeah, because so many people, the new people are coming in at, say, Walsh Bay. They're retired. They don't have kids.
That's right.
Well, their kids are grown up, of course.
Yeah.
That's what's happening.
We have a lot of people that come from the Georgia building and the other high-rise, the old IBM building, which is now the observatory, I think.
Highgate, isn't it?
Highgate, which is just the same. They are retired people. They don't have children. They come down to our church, but there are no young ones. And I think that's indicative of what's going to happen to Millers Point.
You've told me now the things that have got worse in Millers Point. Has anything got better?
No, I don't think so. I don't think it could get better than what it was. You know, maybe I look at it through rose-coloured glasses of my memories of it. But I loved it. I loved living there. I loved the fact that you had a friend, you had neighbours, you had people that cared, and that's not there anymore. So I don't know that it has got better. Like, if bringing high-rise cafes or whatever into Millers Point's better, well then, for those that like that sort of thing, I suppose it's better. But I think they've ruined it. I think they've taken away something they'll never, ever be able to get back.
Right. Well, we hope in this series of recordings that we've done that we've been able to sort of record some of the thoughts and the feelings of some of the residents and former residents. And you too. Is there anything else you want to talk about that maybe something we haven't covered that you want to mention?
No, I don't think so, Frank.
Well, thanks very much, Judy, for this interview. It's been wonderful. So I'll just announce the end of it. This is then the end of the interview with Judy Taylor and the end of tape number MPFH 45, side B.